Wednesday, July 9th. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Today on the show, Cherry, it's a fun one.
Fun day.
We're talking about the best movies of the 21st century. The New York Times, as you know, put out a list of the top 100. It's been getting a lot of buzz, and we wanted to get in on the conversation, too. So, Cherry, you and I dug through the last 25 years of cinema. We came up with our picks. We have two great local experts in. They'll be in studio to give us their picks. We're going to be playing clips through the hour, reacting to the movies, debating the movies, and we want to hear from our audience as well. What do you think are the best films of the 21st century? Have you seen the New York Times list? And if so, what do you think it got right? What do you think it got wrong? Call us 1-888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. Or if you're on YouTube, drop your comments in the chat.
And I'll say that, Kevin, we each had to put a list of three. And it was really, really hard. And so we'll talk about how our individual process for coming up with the list. But it was tough. And I mean, and my initial list included stuff from the 90s. And I was like, oh, that's more than 25 years old. So make sure it's from 2000 to 2025. Because some of our favorite movies, I think, not the 90s, by the way, great decade for film. But I'm looking forward to hearing your comments. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. I can't wait to talk about
it. Before we get into that conversation, of course, as always, our trio of local news stories. And Cherry, big news overnight in the city of Philadelphia.
Yes. After a marathon overnight negotiation session, the city of Philadelphia announced that the two sides have reached a tentative three-year deal and that the DC 33 municipal worker strike is over. The mayor has been speaking right now from City Hall as we host this show. And let me explain the deal. It's a 14% raise for DC 33 workers over the course of 4 years. That includes the 5% raise that they got last year. The mayor's office is calling this deal historic, saying, quote, "We are valuing our workforce and safeguarding the city's hard-earned fiscal stability at the same time." During her comments this morning, the mayor said she is very pro-union and that she was very proud to reach this deal. So our very own Tom McDonald covered the negotiations, and his reporting shows that this looks like it's a big win for the city because it is well below the 32% pay increase that the union leaders asked for initially when they started this strike. DC 33 president Greg Boulware, who was on the show last week, he looked exhausted when he spoke to reporters early Wednesday morning after 12 hours of negotiations. And take a listen to what he had to say.
That your union stood up and fought for you, and we did the best we could with the circumstances we had in front of us.
What's in the best interest of your members?
To be able to earn a living for themselves and their families.
So you're saying a three-year deal?
Correct.
Yeah, and by the way, DC 33 president, he said he told reporters he wasn't necessarily happy with the deal, but he felt like he had been running out of time. And we've been seeing mixed reaction from DC 33 members online so far.
Yeah, the union was clearly in a tough spot here. Yeah. They go on strike and they're testing how much leverage they had. Tomorrow would be the day they would miss a paycheck. And clearly that was starting to build pressure on them. And also the threat of another injunction that might force them back to work. And the union leadership certainly is not broadcasting this as a major win for them. They're not in a celebratory mood. You know, there's some Inquirer analysis out there saying that the 8 days essentially that the workers didn't work in this strike,
if they don't get paid for that,
would make, you know, kind of erases the gains they're going to get in this contract in this first year. So that's a tough pill to swallow. And, you know, you had some reporting out there saying that, you know, the rank and file of the union might be pissed at their own leadership for taking them out on strike and missing that work if at the end of the day they weren't going to deliver a big win for the union.
Yeah, a lot of DC 33 workers not happy with their own leadership. Some of them are still not happy with the mayor. And so the workers, the members of DC 33 still have to ratify this deal. So they have to take a vote for it. And so we'll see what happens. But they're going back to work. The mayor said today that trash pickup will resume on Monday. And now they have to clean up all the buildup that has happened over the last 8 days.
Story number two, Cherry. Waymo, the self-driving car company that's owned by the parent company of Google, Alphabet, is coming to Philadelphia.
Okay, so
not yet, to clarify, not yet for public use, but to test the cars on the streets of Philadelphia starting this summer. Our friends at Billy Penn report the test will occur with a human behind the wheel. Now, Waymo is already ubiquitous in cities like San Francisco and Phoenix. According to Bloomberg, the company has 1,500 cars on the road that complete more than 250,000 paid passenger trips per week. So automated driving is coming, Cherry. It's on the horizon. And the company, we should note, is looking to start full operations in Washington, D.C. next year. That still needs the approval of D.C. mayor and council there. And of course, there's been this debate in recent years about will this make things better on our streets. And the companies who are behind these autonomous vehicles say, yes, when you take human error out of driving, you vastly reduce crashes and accidents and drunk driving, etc. And there's some data that does suggest that that's true, but the sample size at this point is small. And so you have detractors saying, we can't put all of our eggs in this basket. The companies are overhyping the safety stuff on this, and we should be much more reserved in moving forward. So that's the conversation it seems like we're going towards in Philly.
And I want to say this. When I saw that Waymo car, I will say I think I saw one on 90, like on 95 off of Aramingo the other day, and it was driving a little slow. Like, so I'm just going to put that out there. And I'm one of those Philly drivers that I think I tooted my horn at this thing. And it didn't really, you know, it just kept going slow. So anyway, these will be test drives. And you can tell the cars because they're white and they have these little things on the sides. And that's why I'm like, when I saw the picture, I was like, oh, I think I saw one of those. But, you know, by the way, you got to check out that Billy Penn story. It's pretty interesting. They also do a little bit of history on Philadelphia's relationships with robots.
Right.
Going back to Hitchbot, if y'all remember Hitchbot from like 10 years ago. So anyway, cute Billy Penn story that also talks about the realities of autonomous driving coming to Philly.
Story number three, Cherry, big anniversary this weekend.
Yes, this is Live Aid Week in Philly, and we're just 4 days away from the 40th anniversary of Live Aid, one of the most epic global concerts to ever happen and have a place in right here in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't know, I mean, Live Aid took place on July 13th, 1985. The purpose was to raise money for people who were starving in Ethiopia amid the famine of the 1980s. Organizers came together. They pulled some of the biggest stars at the time into this massive concert that was performed on two continents, broadcast live via satellite. Now, that was a pretty big deal in the 1980s. The list of performers included Queen, David Bowie, Paul McCartney, Run DMC, because they were huge at the time, Madonna, Tina Turner, to name a few, as well as Philly's own Patti LaBelle. I want you to take a listen to Miss Patti singing Forever Young on the stage 40 years ago. I mean,
I was going through the clips this morning. I was getting chills.
Look at the goosebumps on my arm right here. Okay. And of course, the concert took place in South Philly at the JFK Stadium before a live audience. Those who couldn't be there watched on TV. And this was, you know, it was interesting to me because the Live Aid concert took place 2 months to the day from the MOVE bombing that happened in 1985. And it was a chance for the city to sort of like clean up and have some good vibes after such a nasty incident.
Yeah. And to clarify there, Queen and David Bowie were on the London side. And
some
of the other artists you said were on the Philly side. I was curious if you kind of scroll through the list, what was the act that you most wish you were at the Philly Live Aid?
Besides Run DMC, I would have loved to see Tina Turner.
Okay. So I was going to say the same thing.
Because
that Tina Turner, Mick Jagger performance.
OMG. That is one that when Tina Turner passed away that I listened to and I was like blown away. And she was just amazing and was on my bucket list of people to see. So I would have loved to see
And they have a whole history, the Rolling Stones and Tina performing together through the years. And it was just kind of like you saw Mick and Tina up there and he's like shirtless for some of it. And he's like rips her skirt off at one point.
Whoa!
It gets a little scandy, Jerry.
This was the 80s, baby. That would have been my pick too.
I mean, yeah. That just would be incredible. And you just kind of see them both in their element, kind of doing their thing.
At like, their top,
right,
in
right
their
in
prime.
Each other's faces, kind of, yeah.
In
yeah.
their prime. And so, yeah, Live Aid will celebrate 40 years in just 4 days. And so coming up, we're going to be talking movies. What do you think are the best films of the 21st century? And if you read that New York Times list, what did they get right or wrong? You can call 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. And we'll be sharing our list coming up after the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron. And today we're talking about the movies that defined this century so far. The ones that shook us, moved us, thrilled us, and maybe even changed how we see the world.
The New York Times recently released its official list of the 100 best movies of the 21st century. And like all great lists, it sparked argument, celebration, and some serious side eye. So today we put together our own best of the century lineup, one clip, one pick, and one passionate defense at a time.
And we brought in two film lovers from our area who spent their careers watching, analyzing, and defending great cinema. They're here with us in studio. We have Badatri Chowdhury. She's the arts and entertainment editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Welcome, Badatri.
Thank you so much.
Friend of the show. You're back.
Yeah, great to be back.
And Rob DiCristino, columnist at F This Movie and member of the Philadelphia Film Critics Circle. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks so much for having me.
Each of us brought three personal picks, and we're going to go around the table to fight for why they belong on the list. But we also want to hear from you, our listeners, and we want to invite you to join the conversation. What do you think are the best films of the 21st century? And if you read the New York Times list, what did the list get right and what did they get wrong? You can call us 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, hello. Be sure to drop your list in the live chat. So we wanted to kind of kick off this conversation by level setting because there were a lot of movies that came out in the past 25 mm-hmm. years. And we were all asked to pick three. Mm-hmm. And so we want you to explain to us your process for whittling down and choosing your three. Badatri, we'll start with you.
Rob and I were just talking before we came in that if you ask me this same question in 2 hours, I'll have completely different set of answers. I think I've already changed my mind since I came up with these three. But, you know, I was going through the list. I was looking out for what did it miss. And I do think there is a geographical bias. These are not all the films that were made in the last 25 years. You know, there are international films that don't make to the list. But I think I was strongly guided by what did these films make me feel, and in all three cases I stopped and thought, oh, films can be made this way, like, you know, this is different from anything I've seen so far. So that was my guiding principle when I picked these three films.
Okay. Yep. All right, Rob.
Exactly similar in process. I also tried to really focus on, it's 25 years, which is only 25 years, but also mm-hmm. those 25 years, there's a grand span. So for my three picks, I tried to go like early 2000s, mm-hmm. mid, you know, the 10s, and then something from the last couple of years to kind of just balance it out. But as you said, there's a geographical bias, there's yeah. a language bias, and if you asked me in 20 minutes, I would probably come up with three others that yes. I would prefer. But
yeah. Okay. I chose films that I became kind of fanatical about.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And that I actually went to the movies to see maybe more than once and possibly took a friend and then would be willing to watch over and over again at home. And so, yeah, I didn't necessarily do the time crunch, but I just picked things that I like personally said, oh my God, I have to see this multiple time and time again. Mm-hmm. And so that was my thought process. How about you, Kevin?
So I kind of was looking at it and thinking about it, and I got to admit also to bring up something you said about timing, there's a strong bias in my list towards the beginning of the 21st century
yeah.
when I was passionate about going to see films, seeing films all the time. I started having children in 2014, and I would say my trips to the movie theater went to almost zero when that
yeah,
happened.
Absolutely.
So a lot of early 21st century stuff, which I think also speaks to like how the industry changed, because as streaming yeah. ramped yeah. up and yes. we got into all these TV shows, that also changed the game. And we can talk about how that affects the movies that were created. But I guess wanted to represent like three big buckets of stuff I like. The one is like super epic movies with big moral themes and giant acting performances. the other's like smaller and like arty and like doing something clever with the writing or the production. And then the other is just like that heartfelt like story where like someone actually changes at the end of it, and like there's growth and character development. So those were kind of my buckets.
Look, and there were so many movies over the past 25 years, but I want a quick shout out to the 1990s because that was a good decade, and I kept putting stuff on the list that were from them, and then I was like, wait, that's not 21st
you get
century.
Angry, and then you get into does the year 2000 count? Yeah, exactly. Like, is it, you know, like,
so yeah, so anyway, we're gonna start the rounds. Go
all
ahead.
Right, so all I get first pick. Yes. And I'm going for No Country for Old Men. So that falls squarely in the bucket of the big epic movie with the giant performances and just, you know, the grand kind of vision of morality. If you don't know the movie, it's a Coen Brothers movie starring Javier Bardem and Tommy Lee Jones and Josh Brolin. And it's almost like this morality play where Anton Chigurh, who's played by
Javier Bardem,
kind of represents this like malevolent force in the world. And you have Tommy Lee Jones as the county sheriff, and he's like trying to keep pace with evil, essentially. And Josh Brolin's kind of like the human character in the middle who stumbles upon this drug deal gone bad where everyone dies and there's money left over. And his decision to take that money just like sucks him into this world of malevolence, which ends up being a terrible choice for him. And the movie kind of plays out with those forces happening. And in the end, you're still wrestling with kind of what happens and that fight between good and evil. Where's it going to go? And the movie, I think, kind of suggests that like the quote unquote good guy is resigning to the idea that he just can't keep up anymore with the evil. The evil is always growing harder and faster. So let's hear a little clip from that movie.
And this is from this, in this famous scene, Anton, Javier Bardem, challenges a gas station owner, Gene Jones, to a coin toss.
What's the most you ever lost on a coin toss?
Sir?
The most you ever lost on a coin toss.
I don't know. I couldn't say.
Call it.
Call it?
Yes.
For what?
Just call it.
Well, we need to know what we're calling it for here.
You need to call it. I can't call it for you.
Well, it wouldn't be fair. I didn't put nothing up.
Yes, you did. You've been putting it up your whole life. You just didn't know it. You know what date is on this coin?
No.
1958. It's been traveling 22 years to get here. And now it's here. And it's either heads or tails. And you have to say, call it.
Okay.
Epic scene.
I have to say, Javier Bardem, creepy good.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That
your
haircut?
Reaction.
Yes.
That haircut, those dark, I'm like... Yeah. This I have not seen this film, No Country for Old Men. I have to see this now.
Yes. It's a must watch. I will say this whole exercise, too, has made me like challenge the way I thought when I was in my early 20s, when these movies were coming out versus now. Because the first movie I was going to put on my list instead of this was There Will Be Blood. Yeah. And I watched that this week.
and I was like,
you know what? I still love this movie, but it's just not as complex. And there's not as much really to wrestle with in that movie. And this one, I feel like, still kind of haunts you in having to wrestle with those big questions I was bringing up earlier.
Yeah, it pulled me in from just, you know, I watched like a 6-minute clip of the film and I was like, oh my goodness, Saturday, this was, we'll be doing this. Yeah.
What's really funny is I just, not for the show, but just reread the novel this weekend, just this past weekend by happenstance. And what I find really impressive about what the Coen brothers did with this is the Cormac McCarthy novel is very talky. Like it's very, there's a lot of long monologues from what ended up being the Tommy Lee Jones character. But the Coens and the actors involved in this were able to shave so much of that off and just get it visual. So there's a beautiful literary quality to the story, but also the filmmaking is so subtle and so strong in that sort of beautiful Coen brothers way that you get just as much out of it as you would have if you're reading these thoughts on the page. Wow. Tommy Lee Jones in this beautiful performance where so much of it is just in his face. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's no face in Hollywood like Tommy Lee Jones. He's just
there's
just so much on his face. And he's able to convey what Cormac McCarthy was conveying on the page with just a nuance, just a look.
Yeah, so good. But Daughtry.
Yeah, I mean, I'm moving away a little bit from the film, but if you just look at the last 25 years and the Coen brothers, it's just like no one film is like the other. Yep. It's an arc that, you know, I could have in my the first time I got thinking when you guys asked me to pick, yeah. I had three Coen brothers films on my list. So it's like, they make No Country for Old Men, then they're making Inside Llewyn Davis, then they're making Ballad yeah. of Buster Scruggs, right? Mm-hmm. And these are not like one right. another. Then they're making films by themselves. I just think...
They're very talented.
Absolutely. And it's like the genius. And I think the last 25 years has shown us that. And then this film obviously stands out yeah. among that.
And so, Badatri, you're up next for okay. your first film. And by the way, we got to move it yeah. a little faster.
Absolutely.
Because we were just drawn in, by yeah. the way. That yeah. first pick yeah. just had us sucked in. Yeah. And so, Badatri, your pick.
My pick is a 2016 film, Moonlight, by Barry Jenkins. Again, like, you know, if you're thinking about filmmakers who've done important work in these last 25 years, I think Barry Jenkins is, and of course, this is not his first film.
And give us a quick line of the plot for people who may not know.
It's about this young boy called Chiron and in Miami, and the entire film is about his boyhood, his growth into as he grows up into a man. He's a queer black man growing up in Miami. The story by itself is really just that, but it's so beautifully filmed and shot. And again, like, you know, I remember watching this film then, and somebody in the audience said, I didn't know you could film black people like that. The way
so beautiful,
the light,
yeah.
the way the light falls on our bodies. I shouldn't say it was never done, but I just think it's so rarely done.
And let's play a clip. Yep. This is Juan, played by Mahershala Ali, who is a drug dealer who becomes a father figure to yeah. a young boy. And he tells him a story about his childhood. Take a look and listen.
This one time, I run by this old lady. I was running, hollering, cutting a fool, boy. This old lady, she stopped me. She said, running around, catching a boy that light. In moonlight, black boys look blue. You blue. That's what I gonna call you. Blue.
Say your name, Blue.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you gonna be. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
That was a good movie.
Yeah.
I remember
that one. And
the
finale, I'm not gonna give anything away. If you haven't watched it yet, please watch it. It's just such a beautiful finale.
Yeah. And yep. I think Mahershala Ali, already a great actor, but mm-hmm. people really started... Yep. paying a lot of attention to him after this film.
It's a, like, where did this come from performance, yes. where you yes. see somebody for the first where time you and you been? Think yeah, you exactly. are a movie yeah. star yeah. From the jump. No, it's a beautiful film.
Yes. And so I get my pick now.
Okay.
My pick is The Dark Knight.
Ooh. Yes.
2008 film, directed by Christopher Nolan. If you don't know, this is of the Batman trilogy. And Bruce Wayne was played by Christian Bale, and he faces off against the Joker, played by Heath Ledger. And, you know, this version of the Joker was one of the most terrifying versions of the Joker, the most realistic versions of the Joker, his makeup alone. And of course, Heath Ledger died a few yes. months yeah. before this movie came out. But I want you to take a look at this clip. It is Batman taking over a police station to interrogate the Joker, who again was played by the late Heath Ledger. Take a look.
Then why do you want to kill me?
I don't want to kill you. What would I do without you? Go back to ripping off mob dealers? No. No, you complete me.
You're garbage. You kills for money.
Don't talk like one of them. You're not. Even if you'd like to be. To them, you're just a freak. Like me. They need you right now. But when they don't, they'll cast you out.
This performance haunted me.
Yes.
And I saw it multiple times in the movies. Whenever I watch it, I almost have to like take a breath because he just channeled something in this performance and it was so good. And of course, he posthumously won an award, an Oscar. Yeah. Yes, it was so good. And there's so many rumors and things swirling about this.
The hilarious thing about that, of course, and if you were there in the sort of film media at the time, we were all losing our minds about Heath Ledger, this pretty boy, being cast as the Joker. Absolutely. He was this teen heartthrob, and everybody was thinking,
"Yeah, 10 Things I Hate
this
About
He did Brokeback Mountain a few years before that, though.
But it was still like, is the Knight's Tale guy? Like, really? And then he turns in this performance, which is just, like, as you said, just it's something so unexpected. But right along the lines of what terrifies us.
And just a perfect movie theater movie, too. I mean, I can remember just being riveted in your seat from the very beginning of the movie through the end. Just like non-stop.
It was the summer of The Dark Knight. We all saw it five times.
I mean, you had to because everybody was talking about it. And it was a political, it was a psychological thrill. It was so many things. So that was on my list. Yes. Yeah. And by the way, I'm going to read a couple of comments. We have Rob, who's on YouTube, who says, I'm a fan of a genre I call supernatural romantic comedies. The Mark Duplass, Aubrey Plaza film, Safety Not Guaranteed, is my example.
It's a good one.
But Palm Springs is also a favorite. Thank you, Rob, for your suggestion.
All right. And now it's over to Rob DiCristino for your pick, Rob.
Palm Springs, by the way, my favorite movie of that year.
Okay.
My first pick here is the 2007 David Fincher masterpiece, Zodiac. Based on the Robert Graysmith book about the hunt for the Zodiac Killer. That's really all the synopsis you need.
All right. Let's take a look at the clip. Robert Graysmith, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, wrist with Dave Toshi, I think.
Dave Toshi,
played by Mark Ruffalo, at a diner in the middle of the night. He is convinced that they have found their suspect. Let's take a look and listen.
This is a case that's covered both Northern and Southern California, with victims and suspects spread over hundreds of miles. Would you agree?
Yes.
Darlene Farron worked at the Vallejo House of Pancakes on the corner of Tennessee and Carroll. Arthur Lee Allen lived in his mother's basement on Fresno Street. Door to door, that is less than 50 yards.
Is that true?
I've walked it.
So, Rob, I'm a big David Fincher fan, but I got to admit, I missed this one. I just never
saw this one completely?
Why is this the one for you?
So, it is obviously a real historical event, which is interesting in itself, watching something that really happened. But for me, Zodiac, what makes Zodiac stand above everything else in Fincher's filmography and almost everything else of the 21st century is it's a movie about obsession. It's a movie about how we get lost in something. It's not a movie, I don't want to spoil history for anybody, but we never caught the Zodiac Killer. Yeah. It's not, the end of the movie doesn't end with somebody in handcuffs. It ends with somebody sort of resigning themselves to the effects of their obsession, obsessing over something that can't necessarily be solved. And the Mark Ruffalo performance is beautiful. The Jake Gyllenhaal performance, he's pretty young when he makes this, Gyllenhaal. Yeah. And it's a really strong kind of leading man, not leading man kind of performance. It's a movie full of faces you recognize, great character actor performances, so evocative of the time period of San Francisco at this time, but so much more than just a sort of cops and robbers thriller. It's about how, you know, do you really ever know the truth? And kind of very similar to No Country for Old Men, where the ending is sort of ambiguous. The ending here, a similar kind of ambiguity where you're left with just the effects of what happened to the character. Interesting. And I think it's beautiful.
I also like how it reworks like everything we know and assume of true crime.
Yes.
And I mean, true crime wasn't as big back then, but maybe this is the film that started it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it kind of does away with all those things. You know, it's not that dramatic, which is what I loved about this film, especially.
Absolutely. Seemed very realistic. By the way, we want to invite our listeners to participate in the conversation. What do you think are the best films of the 21st century? If you read the New York Times list that we're talking about, what did they get right? What did they get wrong? The number is 888-477-9499. That email is studio2@whyy.org. And for those of you watching on YouTube, keep those comments coming in the live chat. And Judy says, OMG, I just saw Zodiac within the last month. Wow, these two guys, so real. And shout out to Christopher, who said Dark Knight is my favorite as well, Cherry. Thank you so much, Christopher, for those comments. And so we're going to go to our next round.
Next round. Yeah. Yes. So we kind of build this as these are our favorites and these are our picks and we're going to pound the table and debate them. I'm going to tell you on this pick, I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
Partly because, again, back to what I said earlier, like my idea for what the best film was became a little different after some rewatching. Mm-hmm. So earlier this week, I thought, you know what? I loved Eternal Sunshine when it came out.
Yeah.
And then last night, my wife and I watched it. And just let's set it up a little bit more. Eternal Sunshine, of course, is this movie directed by Michel Gondry, starring Jim Carrey, Kate Winslet, Kristen Dunst, Mark Ruffalo. Again, Mark Ruffalo gets a good billing on this show today. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially, you know, these two lovers who go through this process to erase the memories that they have of each other because they're too painful after they break up. So let's hear a clip. This is the doctor in the movie, played by Tom Wilkinson, explaining to Joel, who's Jim Carrey, what he needs to do to prepare to have his girlfriend Clementine surgically removed from his memory.
Now, the first thing we need you to do, Mr. Barish, is to go home and collect everything you own that has some association with Clementine. Anything. We'll use these items to create a map of Clementine in your brain, okay? So we'll need photos, clothing, gifts, books she may have bought you, CDs you may have bought together, journal entries. You want to empty your home, you want to empty your life of Clementine.
So there's so much to love about this movie, the cleverness of the writing, the cinematography, some of the interesting camera tricks that they're pulling, and the moments of them falling in love feel so magical and real and interesting. But like, I kind of left it last night thinking this is like a 21-year-old's version of
we
a profound.
Just
had this exact conversation.
We had this conversation.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's like the relationship isn't really that developed. You know, she's kind of this manic pixie dream girl who doesn't really get. I don't know. There's just not a lot of character development there.
You look at it and you're like, I know how this is going to end. Yes. Yeah. When you see the relationship.
So my wife
like,
and I were a little disappointed when we watched back last night. And now I'm a little surprised it landed at number 7 on this New York Times list.
But if I can defend your pick for a second.
Please do.
We were speaking about this before we came on about young people's movies. Because for me, it's the John Cusack oeuvre. It's High Fidelity and Say Anything, where they don't stick with you maybe as much in your 30s, 40s, and beyond. But when you're 16 and you're heartbroken, or when you're 20,
it's a big deal.
When you're 22 and you need, you know, Ebert said that movies teach us empathy, right? So the idea of like, I need a movie to help me understand how to get through this thing I'm feeling.
It's the breakups.
The idea that I want to erase this ex from my mind, and of course, where the movie goes is that you know, you kind of can, and I think it's beautiful in the end, but there is still value to that. So even if we watch it later in life and we think to ourselves, this doesn't really, it's not as strong anymore, the great ones grow with you.
Yeah.
And I think this one grows with you. And even if you're looking at it in a different context, there's still some efficacy there.
But Rob, I kind of agree with you. Just the idea, the idea of it was so profound, being able to erase it and actually helping you think through the process of that as a young person is pretty good.
The one thing I thought was pretty prescient of it is like almost a warning for like the dangers of big tech. And kind of the corruption.
Now, when you look back.
The
corruption
of that whole operation that's happening there.
Yeah.
And then how it eventually like isn't going to give you the thing it says it's going to solve everything in your life. It doesn't actually do that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of parallels in stuff that's happening currently.
Yeah, and then you watch Lobster by Yorgos Lanthimos. And then you kind of put the two together and you're like, oh, modern dating song.
It does. And as, by the way, we're about to go to a break, but we want to invite you to participate in the conversation. We have a caller on the line. We'll bring them in on the other side of the break. But the questions are, what do you think are the best films of the 21st century? And if you read the New York Times list, what did it get right or wrong? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And we're going to have a song sort of play us out of this segment. We have Amelie. Music from Amelie.
So this was our producer Andreas's favorite movie of the 21st century.
So let's take a list.
Thumbs
we'll see you on
Amelie.
The other side of the break.
Absolutely.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory. This hour, we're talking about the best movies of the 21st century, and the music you just heard there was from Greta Gerwig's 2017 film, Lady Bird. That was our producer Debbie's pick for one of the best movies of the century.
Yes, and if you're just joining us, we have two guests in our Philadelphia studio. We have Badatri Chowdhury, the Philadelphia Inquirer's arts and entertainment editor, and Rob DiCristino, a columnist at F This Movie and a member of the Philadelphia Film Critics Circle.
And keep your movie suggestions coming in. What do you think are the best movies of the 21st century? And if you read the New York Times list, what did it get right? What did you get wrong? Call 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
And I want to bring in a caller. Joel from Atlantic City is on the line. Joel, you're on Studio 2. Give us your picks.
Oh, yes. I'm wondering if anybody's seen the movie Safety Not Guaranteed from 2012.
Rob is nodding. Yes.
It's one of the ones that stand out to me. I find it one of my favorites. I can't tell if it's underrated or overlooked or if everybody else likes it, too.
All right. Rob, you want to tell us about the film?
Depends on who you ask, yeah. I think, if it's under or overrated. Yeah. Interesting film. And, like, I think kind of a leader in maybe that what we now call anti-comedy, right? Mm-hmm. The kind of I think you should leave kind of sort of. But there's a surrealist element too as well. Actually, I don't want to give away too much of this movie. I would definitely co-sign the recommendation. I think it's a really interesting, really funny movie. There was a sort of a movement around this time, the sort of, if I'm remembering correctly, that's like early, I want to say early 2010s. I can't remember exactly mm-hmm. when the movie was.
2012, I think.
2012, yeah. But a very interesting early film from the filmmaker, and also a very interesting setup for what a lot of indie comedies will become over the next 15 years after that. It's
all
a cool
right.
movie.
We have to check that out. And so, Badatri, we're picking up on round two. Your pick.
I don't have to defend this. Everyone's with me on this. Mad Max Fury Road 2015.
You're right. You don't have to defend
yeah,
it.
Yeah, nope. I don't. But what amazes me is George Miller made this film after he made Happy Feet.
Yeah.
I'm like, how are you doing this?
Yeah.
And in case anyone needs a reminder, quick reminder, it's set in this post-apocalyptic kingdom where petrol and water are scarce, and Charlize Theron, the role of a lifetime playing Furiosa, leads a rebellion against this evil ruler. And please tell me if you guys agree, when I saw Mad Max, I was like, how did you film this?
Yeah.
Like, you know, and if you still close your eyes, you see that yellow, dusty, and you can almost like feel it in your mouth and eyes.
And let me play a clip. This is Max, who played by Tom Hardy, convinces Furiosa, played by Charlize Theron, to go back through a sun-parched wasteland and take over the Citadel. Take a look and listen.
Yeah. It feels like hope.
I like this plan. We can start again. Just like the old days.
Look. It'll be a hard day. But I guarantee you that 160 days ride that way. There's nothing but salt. At least that way, you know, we might be able to. Together. Come across some kind of redemption.
Wow. And for all of the Mad Maxes, I just love them. But this one was a standout for sure.
And I got to confess, I haven't seen it.
Oh, you will not.
You have homework. You have homework tonight.
Because this came out in 2015. Like I said, I had a newborn and it was like, oh, yeah, I'll see that in a decade. Well, you know what? A decade has passed and it's time for me to see it.
It is time. Yep. For you to see it. So I want to read a comment. We have Judy, who says, speaking of Mark Ruffalo, I recently watched Spotlight, so powerful. It does have a tied up ending, but I appreciate it for its true story. And Michael, kudos to you, says, late to the game, but No Country for Old Men is awesome. I teach film, and the amazing thing about that film is that there is no music.
No music at all? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you for those YouTube comments. So my pick is, because I am a huge Quentin Tarantino fan, and in the early 2000s, he was killing it. And my pick is Kill Bill Volume 1, which came out in 2003, starring Uma Thurman, David Carradine, Daryl Hannah, Vivica A. Fox. And if you don't know this story, it's about the bride, played by Uma Thurman, who is a former assassin, and she goes on this revenge tour to kill all these other former, like, other assassins who tried to assassinate her on her wedding day. And so I want you to take a look at this. This is where Uma Thurman, who is a knife expert, playing the bride, and she pressures a shop owner into giving her his sharpest, sleekest sword. Take a look at this.
Then give me one of these.
These are not for sale.
I didn't say sell me. I said give me.
Why should I help you?
Because my vermin is a former student of yours. And considering the student, I'd say you have a rather large obligation.
And by the way, Uma had been with Bill, this king assassin, mm-hmm. and when you break up with an assassin and get married, he's going to do some assassin type stuff.
It's not
going to
go well for it.
And you can't remove that from your memory, like Eternal Sunshine.
And by the way, I realized who I was in this whole, coming up with this list. I love action. Yeah. I love strong female characters.
Yes.
And Uma Thurman was just kicking behind left and right, and I loved every single moment.
And the yellow jumpsuit, I still remember that yellow
goodness.
Jumpsuit.
Well, I was about to say, the best part about really any Quentin Tarantino movie is you watch it and it's basically a syllabus for 20 other movies you have to watch.
Yes,
you know, Kill Bill, the same thing, where you know these Hong Kong films you can watch, these action films, like it's all references to something else. It's so great.
And you can watch it over and over and over again, and it's still very, very good. Yeah. So, next up, Rob, you have your film pick.
My next pick is my favorite film from my favorite filmmaker, and that is David Lynch's Mulholland Drive.
All right.
2001. How do you describe Mulholland Drive? Mulholland Drive is a sort of surrealist approach to a woman whose Hollywood dreams are not coming true. I'll just put it that way. That might be the best way to describe it.
All right.
You've attempted to impose order on David Lynch. It's already a tough
not a good idea.
And here's the clip. It's a very surreal experience in Club Silencio. Take a listen, look.
No, I banda. There is no band. Il n'est pas d'orchestre. This is all a tape recording. No, I banda, and yet we hear a band. If we want to hear a clarinet, listen.
I'm so glad you picked this movie. I remember vividly seeing this for the first time at one of the Ritz theaters downtown in 2001. And my friend afterwards, and you know, the audience is quiet, just said, what the heck just happened? And I rewatched it within the last year and I felt the same exact thing.
Yeah.
So why do you think it holds up?
So what's beautiful about it, and again, I could do a whole hour on Lynch and I won't, but the idea of, I love story structure. I teach story structure. I love story structure. I love when things make sense. I love movies that I can think my way through and see the logic of. But David Lynch, weirdly enough, is my favorite filmmaker because I can't think through his movies. Yeah. I have to feel through them.
Oh.
So it is, there is a logic you can put on Mulholland Drive. You could say that it is a dream that is then a woman wakes up from her dream and there's another version of her life that's her waking life. And you can add sort of semiotic interpretations on top of that. But what really is interesting about it is just the energy of it, the feel of it, the world, getting sucked into this world where every shot's just a little too long.
Yeah.
Everything lingers in just a way that's a little, so when we talk about dreamlike, we talk about surrealism, those things get put onto Lynch a lot. I think it is so much more of his history as a painter. He trained in Philadelphia as a painter. So it's a painter who becomes a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. So he's painting with the screen, which is different than a classically trained cinematographer, you know? And I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful, heartbreaking, romantic, scary movie. It's just everything.
I think he just challenges you so much. Like everything you know about yourself, about films, you know, you're constantly rethinking when you're watching a Lynch film.
And the common criticism was always, you know, oh, it's weird for weird's sake, but it's not. There is an emotional, again, kind of like symbolic effect of everything.
And so we only have like 5 minutes left on the show, so we're going to have to go really, really quickly. You're up next.
Sure, rapid fire here. I had to pick a movie where character growth, coming of age, Almost Famous. If you don't know it, it's like the autobiographical story of Cameron Crowe, who was a writer for Rolling Stone magazine, and it kind of documents the version of him coming of age. So I love especially the character that is played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. He plays Lester Bangs, this famous rock critic. And he's the one who kind of pushes young William Miller to grow. So let's hear a little clip quick.
You have to make your reputation on being honest and unmerciful. Honest, unmerciful. If you get into a jam, you can call me. I stay up late.
Honest and unmerciful, right? And so it's basically how William Miller goes from being a fanboy to being a true journalist.
Yeah, there you go. I actually really co-sign on that movie. I really like that movie.
For sure.
Okay, so Badatri, you're up. Rapid fire.
Yeah, very quickly. I think Pedro Almodovar is one of those other filmmakers who define these 25 years for me. And I actually had a hard time picking which one of his films I should pick. But I really love this film called Pain and Glory, where Antonio Banderas plays an actor. And this entire film is about him going back and forth in time and talking about his past and how he overcame all of that. And then how art eventually won, and he went on to create art. I just think Almodovar is such a beautiful filmmaker, and the way he uses women, not in a fetishistic way, but just the way he writes women and the way he uses color in his cinematography. I just think for anyone who hasn't watched his films, absolutely, like, I think he's one of the highlights for me in modern cinema.
Yeah, and because we only have a couple minutes left, we're not going to play any more clips.
Okay.
But my pick was Black Panther because it was a Marvel comic, if you don't know, that follows T'Challa as he returns to the fictional African nation of Wakanda. And this, I'm not a Marvel fan, have never been big into comic books, had never heard of Black Panther really before this film, but I saw it four times in the movies.
But you're a Chadwick Boseman fan.
I am a Chadwick Boseman fan, and I loved him in so many films. And it was just so good. And they had Killmonger, which was a great, you know, villain in this film. And I just feel like it changed culture. I went to parties dressed up in Wakanda outfits. It created a whole fandom, and it made $1 billion, which put black superheroes on the map. So I had to put that in out there. And so, Rob.
Well, like as I said, I wanted to pick something fairly recent, and I'm going with what I believe to be Christopher Nolan's best film, which is 2023's Best Picture winner, Oppenheimer. I think it's the most important movie about American identity in the 20th century. I think it's a movie about guilt. It's a movie about conquest. It's a movie about ideas. It's a movie about innovation, but it's also a movie about how we live with the things that we've done.
Yeah, that's so good. You did it. That's, Rob, that is such a good summary of that movie. And I have not seen Oppenheimer.
Oh, you should check it out. Yeah.
And it's been on my list, but now you make me want to go check it out.
It's beautiful.
So we've had, I feel like we had some really good films, and I want to read from some of our comments. Kay South on YouTube said, I just rewatched Eternal Sunshine, and that film stands up. The camera work is so cool. The broader implications for technology, amazing. Becky from Barnegat Light, New Jersey says Barbenheimer. So Oppenheimer and the Barbie summer.
I did both in that day. When they came out, I did do both in that day.
Yeah. Patty says you did both.
It wasn't a good idea.
That was did you have a break? A
I had
snack?
Seen them both already.
Okay.
So then I did them again.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, okay. Email from Mike, who says the documentary Three Identical Strangers from 2018 sticks out as a great one. This
good
story
one.
About triplets from New York City resonates with me since it's nonfiction, and especially since I am an identical twin. Yeah. So there are some similarities there.
We need also a whole episode on documentary.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't even touch documentary.
Non-English language films. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole,
And by the way, do you guys have any honorable mentions?
Ooh.
That you want to throw out there?
I think, Rob, both you and I had The Handmaiden on our list.
Yes, The Handmaiden, absolutely.
So what's that about?
What's it not about?
It is a queer love story between the handmaiden and the princess in, I don't remember the time frame, but in like old Korea. And It's about that human relationship, but also about how these two women manipulate emotions in a beautiful way. It's a South Korean film, so obviously it's going to screw with your head a little bit. But yeah, did you want to add more?
I'm going to bounce off of it and say Wong Kar-wai is In the Mood for Love.
Oh.
Get some more non-English language films in there. Another sort of understated romance about sort of misconnections and ships passing in the night, and it's this beautiful moody kind of, again, very romantic kind of ethereal kind of movie. I love it.
Right, and by the way, Kelly sent us a whole list: Avengers, Endgame, Parasite, Cloud Atlas, Tenet, Parasite, Inception, Interstellar, The Prestige, The Woman King, Encanto, a whole list, almost 100, I would say.
Yeah.
But thank you to everybody who emailed in.
Great conversation.
Great conversation today. I want to say thank you so much to Badatri Chowdhury, Philadelphia Inquirer's arts and entertainment editor, and Rob DiCristino, columnist at F This Movie and a member of the Philadelphia Film Critics Circle. Thank you for sharing your list with
us.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you for having
us.
This
is great.
The music we're hearing right now is from the 2001 animated film Spirited Away. That's producer Paige's pick for one of the best movies from the 21st century.
Yes. And Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Bilder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer and my guest host here is Kevin McCory from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCory. Thanks for joining us.